I reread, in preparation for this week, the Bob Brenner piece, which was assigned for the course of this week's readings. If you haven't read it, I think you can skip it, actually. It's too hard for the task at hand. It's not that you won't get something out of it if you read it, but given the amount of preparation for that particular piece, I just think it's too much to contend with. And I shouldn't have assigned it, probably. Well, I definitely shouldn't have assigned it. It's unnecessary for the purposes to which we're studying crisis. That is the function, the idea is this, that after we finish going through the critique of the general, of the special theory of capitalist history in its classic form, we're then going to turn to a number of attempts at having, of giving an account of capitalist development that don't have as well programmed a theory of its destination. So the classic theory that Marx attempted was a special theory of capitalist history that actually gave us a determinate destination to that history. That was the task that Marx set and which we've been examining. The theoretical positions for a theory of capitalist development that we'll be looking at this week have many of the same ingredients that was present in Marx's argument, but don't attempt to give a destination. They don't attempt a theory of the demise of capitalism, just a theory of its contradictory course of development. And it was in that context that I thought that Bob Brenner's attempt at providing a theory of the current era of crisis tendencies would be useful. He is one of the influential writers on these themes these days, but I think in the end his piece, certainly the excerpt I assigned, but also more generally his exposition is pretty turgid, written in a way that isn't as accessible as it should be, and there's not that much payoff for you to struggle through it. This isn't a quiz to see if you've read this. Did anybody read it and find it easy or opaque or? I'm just interested in what your reaction, if anybody. So I take it that as either an indicator that you haven't yet gotten to it or that it wasn't going to be gotten to. But you don't have to get to it in any case. You can put that on for future edification if needed. All right. So let's go back to the to Marx's attempt at a theory of capitalism's futures. The first ingredient which I laid out the five theses and was beginning the critique of them. The first criticism centered around the theory of crisis intensification, in which what I argued is that while there may be, indeed I think there are, very good reasons, both in Marx and in subsequent writers, to believe that capitalism has inherent tendencies towards crisis, that a capitalist economy can never be in a permanent stable equilibrium, that there will always be business cycles of varying amplitudes, there's no really good reason to believe that there's a systematic tendency for crisis to intensify over time and to become more and more unmanageable, and that across crises, the troughs become deeper and the peaks become shallower, reflecting a long-term tendency for the rate of profit to decline. That the arguments behind that view are either wrong or unsatisfactory, unconvincing. Now, this isn't the same as an even stronger rejection of the classical theory, which says we have a positive theory that the rate of profit does not decline over time. I just think we don't have a good theory of the long-term trajectory of the rate of profit, at least not one that I found compelling. And therefore, we can't say anything about the long-term tendencies for intensification of crisis. Now, the key problem which that then poses for the classical theory is the classical theory put a lot of weight on increasing vulnerability to challenge of the system as a whole. But the system doesn't become more stable over time, more defendable over time, or uncertain defendability, but rather there was this strong prediction that the system as a whole becomes more vulnerable over time. That was the part of the theory that enabled slogans such as "history is on our side" to have some weight. The idea that there was a future beyond capitalism, which we could really anticipate, because we knew that capitalism was going to destroy its own conditions of existence. And the key to the destroying the conditions of existence was that the system became more fragile, more vulnerable to challenge. I don't think that part of the theory is sustainable. It can be that capitalism becomes more and more undesirable over time. That is, there may be more and more reasons. The reasons why we object to it may increase over time. The gap between how life could be and how it is could grow over time. That seems very plausible to me, and good arguments can be made that the gap between how we live our lives and how we could live our lives under an alternative, that gap increases over time. And yet the system as a whole doesn't become more fragile. That is, its ability to reproduce its own conditions of existence doesn't decline. And it's only the latter that gives us the strong prediction that capitalism, the destiny of capitalism, is its demise. It's not enough to show that an alternative is better and that the gap between what could be and what is grows. That's not sufficient to show that the destiny of capitalism is its demise, because the transition costs to get to the alternative may be too big. And the forces arrayed to the challenge may be too strong. It's never enough to show that grievances intensify to show that a system becomes weaker. Now, when I say never enough, I don't mean that it doesn't say anything. The fact that the gap between how we live our lives and how we could live our lives increases, that indeed is absolutely at the core of any radical critique to motivate people to try to transform a system, is that things could be better. And if the gap increases, that provides more weight to those arguments. So the criticism of capitalism is retained, and that as the basis for struggles to transform the world increase. It's just that it's operating against a system which doesn't inherently become more fragile. And that suggests that the nature of the challenges have to take that into account. They have to pose the problem: how do you challenge a system that isn't becoming inherently more fragile, and yet whose oppressions are robust and are deepened, and alternatives become more desirable? How do you challenge such a system? Well, that's a different task from how do you challenge a system that is weakening over time. And that's one of the themes we'll be talking about on the weekend. What are the strategic implications of the opacity of the future, basically? Not having a good basis for arguing for a well-understood trajectory into the future. What are the implications of that for the kinds of strategies we adopt in the present? Okay. That's the first thesis, remember, of the five theses of the special theory of history. The first thesis was the intensification of crisis, or the long-term non-sustainability of crisis thesis, I think. Is the label I gave it. I don't have my... Well, whatever. I think that was the first. The second thesis was the intensification of class struggle thesis. The intensification of class struggle thesis was based on a particular set of arguments about the transformations of the class structure of capitalism as capitalism developed, and the implications of the transformation of the class structure for the nature of class struggles. I just want to get the actual somewhere. I should have put these back in the proper page orders, but I to give the actual. Lecture 26.
It's on page 3.
Yeah, I just can't find page 3. Oh well, it doesn't. The first criticism then is on the basic theory of proletarianization. The theory of proletarianization argues that as capitalism develops, the class structure becomes increasingly polarized between a capitalist class and a working class for two kinds of reasons. One is pre-capitalist class relations are destroyed increasingly, in particular small self-employed artisans, small shopkeepers and so forth are destroyed. The petty bourgeoisie is destroyed. And secondly, within the capitalist class structure, there is a general process of de-skilling which leads to an increasingly polarized internal class structure within capitalism. Now, it is true that in the course of capitalist development, an increasing proportion of the population is directly incorporated under capitalism. So capitalism becomes more comprehensively the way of organizing class relations in capitalist societies. That, I think, is a robust finding, a tendency within capitalism. But it is not true that within developed capitalist countries, this has resulted in a long-term process of increasing homogenization of the labor force and increasing polarization of the overall class structure. Marx basically believed that increasing homogenization, that is, the population subordinated to capitalist relations, would increasingly have identical interests with respect to capitalism. They would be increasingly located within capitalism in the same way. Whereas I think, in fact, the course of capitalist development has led to increasing complexity in the class structure, where the individual locations of persons are situated within capitalist relations in more complex rather than in simpler ways. And those various forms of complexity we discussed when we looked at the class structure of contemporary capitalism. There are contradictory locations. Lots of wage earners occupy positions of authority within capitalist production. Somewhere around 20% of employees, maybe as high as 30%, depending upon how you measure it, have delegated powers over other workers. That's the order of magnitude with respect to authority. And even if you apply fairly stringent criteria, so we don't want to say a person has power over other workers when all they do is convey instructions from above. So we will not count as having authority if you are merely a conduit for information and instruction. You have to have actual control over subordinates. So even if we restrict the notion of authority over subordinates, you still, in no developed capitalist country, can you push the number of managers and supervisors down much below 25% of the labor force. Obviously, measurement issues come into play here. I think as a kind of rule of thumb, you should think of it as somewhere between 20 and 25% is probably the unambiguous contradictory location involving authority. And that's apart from contradictory locations that involve all sorts of other kinds of special advantages that certain categories of workers have within the capitalist relations of production, particularly around the control over technical knowledge and high levels of expertise of various sorts. Now, however you want to conceptualize those kinds of positions, professional technical workers, highly skilled and highly paid employees, However you want to conceptualize them, whether you want to say this is merely a fraction of the working class or a contradictory location or whatever, it still violates the homogenization principle. It still shows that deepening proletarianization is not, in fact, a central tendency of developed capitalist economies. And that's only one of the additional complexities. There's also the additional complexity that actual ownership of capital, that is, the percentage of the population that owns stocks in real capitalist firms. And I mean owns stocks not in the sense of simply having a pension, but actually buys and sells stocks. They have investments. The proportion of the population that has investments has steadily increased, even though the concentration of ownership remains extremely high, and in fact had increased as well until recently. Well, till the crash. The crash has this byproduct effect of at least temporarily creating more equality in the ownership of capital, because the biggest losses were from the richest people. There's less concentration of capital because now than there was 2 years ago. Not by a lot, but there's less concentration of capital. But roughly 35% of the population owns some stock. It used to be 2 or 3% of the population. 35% of the population owns some stock, and that includes many skilled workers who own some stock, who have investments. The reason why on television you have brokerage firms being advertised, television is a mass medium. It's not the ideal way to advertise things if you're targeting elites. You advertise Schwab brokerage firms on football programs because lots of people who are not themselves capitalists nevertheless invest some capital. Yeah.
To what extent do you think that this 35% is constituted of people who own like meaningful portions?
Well, I'm not. All I'm saying is this is an additional complication in the class structure. Most people, the investments of most of that 35% represents a stream of future income that counts as discretionary income. You know, it's a supplement to their basic standards of living. It's not the core of how they gain their material conditions of existence. It does provide insurance. It's a kind of risk, you know, security. It does affect their orientation towards capitalism. You know, it means that they watch the stock market because they have a personal stake in how things go. And it adds complexity. I regard the ownership of capital through stock markets by workers as a particular form of contradictory class location. There's a contradictory location between their status within the relations of production in work and their status within the property relations of the economy, because they become partial, if limited, owners. And it's not always trivial. There are plenty of people, for example, who are who are skilled workers, carpenters, you know, electricians, who have sufficient discretionary income that if they decide to save and invest, they can capitalize to use the economist language, they can capitalize the rents that they get in their wages. And they do. You know, so I know people who are carpenters who also own apartment buildings. You know, they borrowed and they had enough collateral, they bought apartment buildings and have invested them, they do the repairs on them, and they're basically construction workers and landlords. That kind of contradictory location is sufficiently prevalent, it's not such a rare outlier, that it is part of the class structure. It becomes part of how people think about their lives and their possibilities. It means that the space of strategic choices that individuals have available to them include individual strategies of savings, and investing and diversifying their portfolio between their labor portfolio and their capital portfolio. This kind of mystificatory language, which is still mystifications because it's not realistically available to most people as a way of actually creating long-term security, nevertheless is part of the ideological and material environment that individuals experience in a complex developed capitalist country, and violates the, I think, the theory of proletarianization. It makes for a complex rather than a simplifying environment, and therefore a complex rather than a simplifying array of interests that individuals face. And then when you add to this family structures, because of mediated class locations, cross-class families, you add that complexity. And you add the temporal dimension, the career structures, where futures are not so locked in place for a significant portion of the labor force. I mean, if we think of the non-core capitalist class, you know, people who basically earn their living by selling their labor power as being roughly 80+% of the population, somewhere. Again, there are some counting problems, but let's call it as a rough figure, 85% of the population. If, you know, half of that 85% have as a realistic part of their strategic menu, how much should we save and invest? How much should we consume? How should we organize our long-term strategies? If roughly half of that population can realistically play in that game, and another quarter think that they might be able to play that game at some point in the future, you then have a class structure in which polarization is not the central reality in the lived experience and strategic environment of most people. Even if it remains the case that somewhere between, you know, a third and half of the entire population are really working class, whose lives are really defined by the structures of power and exploitation of capitalism in a straightforward way. It's just not. It's just a more complicated environment.
Is the tendency of the skilling of workers in developed countries confirmed by empirical work?
The de-skilling in.
Yeah.
You know, I think all of these complexities are refracted again in the developing world as well. There, one response to this increasing complexification within the developed countries has been an argument that the world is becoming simplified, even if there's more complexity in the developed world. So we have a global polarization where you have a world proletariat which is de-skilled and homogeneous. And then you have a complex global middle class in the north, which consists of northern workers who have all these contradictory location attributes. That's been one kind of story that some people have told. I'm not convinced by that. When I look at people who do research on class in developing countries, there's all sorts of new forms of complexity there as well. The whole formal-informal economy problem, for example, is a huge kind of complexity in the third world. And the strategies that actors have to become part of the core of the formal economy, which there is a core formal economy with lots of privileges and advantages, the fact that in third world countries state employees have these, you know, lavish, often in many places, even in poor countries, lavish pensions by the standards of those societies, and that the states are bloated. They have lots of employees. That's a complexity of class structure. And then what we observe, whether it be China or India or Brazil now, is those countries are moving up the value chain and having increasingly high-tech production with highly skilled labor and increasingly involved with all sorts of innovative practices. It's not clear that the Brazilian trajectory is towards increasing de-skilling of its labor force as a whole. Now, this is always tendency and counter-tendency. There's homogenization and fragmentation going on at the same time. it's very hard for me to see how this can be told as a tale of increasing transparency and simplification, which was at the core of the intensification of class structure, class struggle thesis. That is, the second thesis had as one of its central elements the fact that the transparency of capitalist relations increased over time. Polarization made it easier rather than harder to mobilize people. And that's why, you know, the first two theses together, the system as a whole, for systemic reasons, became more fragile. And the challengers as a whole, for systemic reasons, became more homogeneous. And those two together increased the ability of the challengers to challenge and reduce the ability of the defenders to defend. You know, that's the coincidence of those two theses is really what enabled you to predict the destiny of capitalism. And both of those theses are problematic. The next of the other element of the intensification of class structure, of class struggle argument, was the increase in class capacity thesis. This was partially just a result of the increasing homogenization argument. That is, the idea was the more homogeneous workers were, the easier it would be to form them into a collective actor, because there'd be fewer internal conflicts of interests that would otherwise fragment the working class. So homogenization itself contributed to class capacity. But in addition, Marx and subsequent Marxists had a whole variety of additional reasons why they thought class capacity would increase over time, as a general tendency, that the general tendency to increase over time. And a lot of that had to do with a vision for how production was organized, that it would be organized in ever larger units of production. Labor processes would become more interdependent. They would be geographically concentrated in ways that increase the communications and so forth among workers. So class capacity would increase both because of homogeneity and because of all these socio-spatial relational changes of capitalism, which would increase the ability of workers to form collectivities. I think the theory of class capacity has also proven not to be very robust. On the one hand, on the structural side, globalization, the organization of labor processes on huge geographical scales with very fragmented interconnections between them means that you can have increasing interdependency of workers. That is, workers engage in activities in the United States today that are interdependent with workers in Mexico and Brazil. They are all part of the global labor process through commodity change that link their activities together in a coherent way. So on the one hand, that is interdependency. But it's not geographically concentrated interdependency. So it's not the kind of interdependency that builds capacity, because it doesn't correspond to the sorts of interactions between people that builds trust, shares information, and communication, and so on. So at the structural level, class capacities are problematic. Now, in each case, what I would argue is, against the simple thesis of a tendency towards increasing class capacity, I wouldn't make the counter argument. I'm not making the strong negative argument. That is, we have a theory of the increasing incapacity of the working class. I think there are tendencies and counter tendencies. There are ways in which collaboration between North American and Central American workers may be increasing over time because of the nature of communications technologies and the ability to coordinate over long spatial distances. So it's complicated. I'm just saying that the simple view isn't satisfactory. The other thing which the original theory did not anticipate was the possibility of pretty robust class compromises. You know, those sort of positive sum, upward sloping part of my class compromise curve. The pretty stable class compromises could be forged at the point of production and at the societal level. So there are firm level class compromises that actually work and create much more collaborative relations between workers and capitalists than the theory proposed. And societal compromises, especially under social democratic conditions that create pacts at the political level, that actually are pretty robust and that haven't disappeared, even if they've become less secure than they were in the past. The possibility of positive class compromise therefore means that increasing class capacity may not result in increasing class struggle against capitalism. Increasing class capacity can lead to new equilibria of class forces within capitalism, so that the increasing class capacity of the working class actually helps to stabilize capitalism rather than to threaten it. And that really was not an idea that was taken seriously in the classical theory. So we now have 3 points I've argued against the strong expectations of the traditional theory. The theory of crisis intensification is not well grounded. The theory of proletarianization has been contradicted by increasing complexity, and the theory of class capacity has also of increasing class capacity, the struggle against capitalism has also, I think, not proven robust. The next thesis in the classical theory was the revolutionary transformation thesis. Now, of course, if we really don't accept the first two theses, then the theory of revolutionary transformation thesis itself doesn't follow. The thesis three in the original structure of my argument, the revolutionary transformation thesis, really depended upon the first two theses. It was a prediction about revolutionary transformation given the increasing vulnerability of the system and the increasing capacity to challenge the system. That given those two, thesis one and thesis two's validity, then we could predict that at some point the capacity to transform would be sufficiently strong and the system would be sufficiently weak that a revolutionary transformation would occur. And that this would occur before the full non-sustainability of the system occurred. That is, the extreme case is that revolution only happens when the system is actually not sustainable. But given these two trajectories, the trajectory of increasing incapable struggle and decreasing strength of the system, there's no reason to imagine that the point at which those two curves, as it were, cross is at the end point of the sustainability curve. One would expect, therefore, revolutions to transform social systems prior to the point of non-sustainability of the system. It would have been weakened sufficiently, even before it reaches non-sustainability, that it would become transformable. Well, if we drop those two theses, then the revolutionary transformation thesis becomes itself less plausible because its foundations have been brought into question. But I think there's an additional problem with the theory of ruptural transformation, and this is a problem which we will again explore on the weekend when we discuss strategic logics. You can have a theory of ruptural transformation even if you don't have a theory of intensifying crisis and a theory of intensifying class struggle. Right? So even without those two, you can still have a theory of revolutionary transformation. The theory of revolutionary transformation says that it is through revolutionary struggle that capitalist systems will be transformed, whenever the conditions make possible their transformation, without knowing when those conditions might be. So you can say, we don't have a theory of when those conditions will occur. We can't predict that they will increase in likelihood. All we can say is that there will be some time in the future where there will be revolutionary opportunities, because there will be shocks and instabilities and crises. And at some point, those will create windows of opportunity for revolutionary transformation. Yeah.
Yeah, but if we disregard the previous thesis, we don't have revolutionary actors.
So then you substitute a revolutionary party that has a kind of vanguardist...
No, even industrial workers as a class for revolutionary struggle, not just the organization.
Right, so what happens is, in the absence of those structural arguments, you get a more voluntaristic theory, right, where through the force of ideology and persuasion and solidarities of that are grounded in revolutionary aspirations, not just grounded in the material interests of actors, but in revolutionary aspirations, you then get a much more voluntaristic vision of how the capacity for struggle could be constituted by a revolutionary movement. I'm just saying, you can reconstruct a theory of revolutionary transformation even if you drop the first two theses. It's just that you can if you drop the first two theses, you no longer have grounds for strong predictions about the success of such revolutionary movements. But you could still believe that that's the only possible way of transforming systems. And that the best you can hope for is, therefore, through the acts of revolutionary persuasion and ideological transformation, you'll create the kinds of cohesions and solidarity necessary to do it, given that the dynamics and laws of motion of capitalism aren't going to create the raw materials in a necessarily advantageous way. So you'll have to do it much more through a kind of charismatic, ideologically powerful and compelling organizational vision. Now, I'm saying that's how you would that's the way you could reconstruct a theory of revolutionary transformation in the absence of the first two theses. Still, I think even if one is prepared to make those moves as a way of maintaining a theory of revolutionary or a theory of ruptural transformation, of revolutionary transformation, I'm skeptical that that would provide an actual theory of revolutionary transformation towards socialism. The question, and this is again a question we will explore when we look at theories of ruptural strategy on the weekend. The problem is this. We do observe in history that there have been revolutionary challenges to capitalism. These have happened from time to time. There are no examples of them ever happening in a developed capitalist country. There's been no remotely plausible revolutionary challenge to capitalism in a developed capitalist country, and no successful revolutions in any developed capitalist country. Adam Shavorsky has a nice paper where he looks at the probabilities of revolutionary overthrow of states as a function of the per capita income of the population. And there are zero cases once the per capita income of a population gets above some modest threshold. I forget what the number is. Now, the fact that there have been zero cases doesn't mean that there could be no cases in the future. It's just that there has never been a case of a revolutionary movement that has occurred in a wealthy country where the average income of people is well above subsistence, above basic subsistence. And furthermore, in every instance where we have observed a revolutionary overthrow of states against capitalism, in every instance, they've resulted in the construction of alternatives which do not satisfy what I would consider to be socialist democratic ideals. They have been anti-capitalist, but have not been able to actually institutionalize something that we could reasonably call socialism. And therefore, I think there's good grounds to be skeptical of the revolutionary transformation thesis. And there'd be grounds to be skeptical of that thesis even if one wanted to retain elements of the first two theses. That is, even if you were less convinced that the first two theses are wrong, if we take as our criteria for what makes you confident in a theoretical argument that there is some historical evidence to support it, and there are good theoretical reasons to imagine, given that historical evidence, that the thesis is sound, I think the revolutionary transformation thesis is one that one should be skeptical about. So that will be the more the theme, one of the themes for the weekend discussion of what are the visions of the alternative, what do we mean by socialism, and what does it mean to move beyond capitalism? And given what we mean by those alternatives, what's our strategic menu for transforming the existing world towards those goals? Where does that leave us with respect to a historical materialism? On page 10, I list what I consider to be the kind of takeaway points from this discussion of the general theory of history and the theory of the special history of capitalism. And I'd summarize them as follows. First, one of the elements of historical materialism, one of the core elements, I think, is robust. I do think there's a sticky downward tendency for the development of the forces of production. And therefore, I think the development of the forces of production will tend to have a cumulative directional character. This suggests that history does have at least some weak directionality to it, and that historical reversal is unlikely, because knowledge is cumulative and our capacity to transform nature is something which is anchored in knowledge. That's one element of the general theory that I think we can retain. A second element of the classical theory that I think has at least some robustness is the idea that different forms of relations of production are functionally compatible with different levels of development of the forces of production. So that given a set of productive forces, a given set of productive forces can only be productively deployed under certain forms of production relations. So one of the elements of classical historical materialism, that in addition to the forces of production developing over time, we become more productive in our capacity to transform nature, there's some forms of correspondence between forces and relations of production that are stable and other forms that are not. So there's a non-arbitrary connection between these two aspects of a society, the forces and relations of production. And putting those two together gives us some, at least weak, way of thinking about historical epochs. So that capitalism as an historical epoch is something that will happen at later stages of development of the forces of production than will pre-capitalist class, non-capitalist class societies. And so that basic idea that the epochs of history from pre-class societies to pre-capitalist class societies to capitalism, that part of the historical trajectory does seem connected to the development of the forces of production in a way that at least tracks the central arguments of classical historical materialism. But those elements, and this would be the fourth conclusion, are not sufficient to give us what we really want, which is a theory of capitalism's own destiny. That is, the epical theory that gets us to capitalism does not provide us with the tools we need to understand the destiny of capitalism. Still, we do have a powerful critique of capitalism. That is, none of this implies a rejection of the theory of exploitation and domination and oppressions within capitalism and how these particular structures of power organized around economic institutions create deep and important harms. So the critique of capitalism is not called into question by our inability to have a good theory of the destiny of capitalism. And nor does our ability to formulate an emancipatory understanding about the potential for a better way of organizing social life. That is, our understanding about emancipatory potential centers around our understanding about how the forces of production create sufficient productivity that gives us more possibility rather than less possibility in how we organize our social institutions. We have greater limits of possibility because we are a highly productive society than we would have if we were a very unproductive society. High productivity makes possible the liberation of time for social purposes. That is not possible when human time has to be overwhelmingly used to simply provide the basic subsistence of life. So high productivity opens up new possibilities. The critique of capitalism remains intact around exploitations and oppressions. The high productivity of the forces of production gives us strong reason to believe that emancipatory alternatives are thinkable, and then what we need is a way of understanding how those imaginable possibilities can become real possibilities. What we have for that, and this gets to the, this is the sixth point of the conclusion, what we have is many of the basic elements of a theory of the contradictory quality of existing institutions. So the notion that the existing world is filled with contradictions is something which we can retain from the Marxist tradition for analyzing social structures and institutions. That what we face in capitalism is contradictory institutional impediments to the realization of that emancipatory potential. The theories of the state and the theory of ideology provide us with those ingredients. The theory of the state and the theory of ideology both explain why it's hard to realize those potentials, but why the difficulties are contradictory, what I would therefore call contradictory impediments or contradictory obstacles to the realization of this potential. That's what we get from the theory of state, of the state and ideology. A developed theory of the state and a developed theory of ideology are not just an account of why we can't change anything. That is, the kind of purely functionalist account of the state would say why existing structures make it impossible. What I think the more developed theories of the state and theories of ideology help us understand is the contradictory obstacles to the realization of these potentials. And then finally, this can form the basis for new thinking about how to take advantage of the contradictions to advance an emancipatory project. Given that we don't know the endogenous dynamic trajectory of capitalism towards a destiny. So this is a much more open and less certain theoretical context for thinking about alternatives and how to struggle and realize them than was hoped for in the classical theory. Okay. I think, we can discuss these issues for a little bit, and then we'll take a break, and I will then turn to the more recent arguments for a specific theory for the trajectory of capitalist development, particularly focusing on Giovanni Arrighi's analysis and how he formulates the problem. But I've noticed heads shaking or grimaces through various aspects of my summary of the lessons from the evaluation of historical materialism. So I'm sure there's some of you who have things you want to raise. Yeah.
Can you talk about or clarify a little bit what you're referring to as contradictory impediments from the from theories of state and ideology?
So by a contradictory impediment from the theory of the state, I would mean things like the democratic capitalist state acts as a set of institutions to deflect struggle and to contain conflict within limits that are compatible with capitalism. But they also provide ways of people to make demands and to capture particular parts of particular forms of state apparatuses and to engage in new projects of institution building. So democratic capitalist states both create opportunities for things like the participatory budgeting in Porto Alegre. I mean, that would be an example that I would use. The participatory budgeting process in Porto Alegre occurred in a capitalist state. It didn't occur in some other kind of state. Porto Alegre Brazil is a capitalist country. Porto Alegre had a city government that was part of the state apparatuses of capitalism. There was a particular historical moment when a left-wing party was able to gain power in the city and to create new institutions to allow more participation and direct democratic involvement in shaping the priorities for what the city did. In a way that was very non-capitalist, very much prefigurative of what an emancipatory alternative to the capitalist state would be. The participatory budget is a different logic of policymaking than would be characteristic of a capitalist state. If you look at Terborn's criteria for what makes a capitalist state, the participatory budget violates them. And yet it's possible within capitalism because of the contradictory character of democratic institutions. Democratic institutions in a capitalist economy allow for popular power to have some expression, and then in some times and places, that popular power can institute new innovations. Then the question is whether, and this is the big strategic question that we'll be discussing on the weekend, whether it's plausible to imagine that the cumulative effect over a long period of time of such contradictory openings, where you get these special circumstances that allow for new institutions to be elaborated and developed inside of capitalism, whether those have a ratchet-like character, that you can make gains, you can consolidate a new equilibrium, and then open up spaces for future gains, so that transformation of a system becomes possible through metamorphosis, through that kind of internal transformative project, or whether that's illusory. The idea of an emancipatory transformation through metamorphosis is the kind of counterpoint to emancipatory transformation through rupture. And the question is whether there's a plausible theory of such metamorphosis, given the fact that we don't have a plausible theory of rupture. Let me make one other. This is again anticipating somewhat the discussion on the weekend. In the 1890s to 1920s, sort of in that window of time, when there was, and this then extended in new forms later, but I think that was the key period of time, when there was a debate between reformism and revolution, and between kind of ruptural visions and what was, I think, not quite precisely described as incremental transformation. The word incremental doesn't capture, I think, what's really in play here as well as metamorphosis does. But in any case, in that sort of discussion, reformism was seen as an alternative to revolution at a time when revolution was seen very broadly as a plausible strategy. So it's quite different to have a debate between a reformist, how do you subvert and transform a system from within through strategic transformations that open up spaces and change the logics of a system in a piecemeal way, but which cumulatively amounts to a qualitative change. It's quite different to have a discussion of reformism versus revolution under circumstances where revolution is seen as plausible, as really having a scenario. You can tell a good narrative and you can have credible predictions about what would happen if, and that the historical evidence at that time, from what world history had given us as the empirical cases, made it a plausible way of thinking about transforming capitalism. It's quite different to have that discussion in that context than to have that discussion 150 years later, where we have much more data. You know, we've had more experiments than they had in 1890. We have many more experiments about the implications and ramifications of different strategies. None of the experiments are perfect experiments because they all occurred under the kinds of conditions where you can explain away the failures by invoking various factors. But nevertheless, we are in a much richer empirical environment for having these kinds of discussions. So I don't think that the reform versus revolution discussion today should be seen as simply a repetition of that discussion of 100 plus years ago. Because the world is different. And the world is different means we have more data, so we actually have more raw materials around which to build our arguments, but we're also contending with a different structure. The nature of the institutional configurations in which struggles occur today are not the same as they were 120 years ago, and therefore what it means to have a plausible strategy is different today from what it meant then. Other queries? Yeah.
My question is about the production relations and the productive forces, the development thesis. So look at our history, the transformation from feudal societies, from slave society to feudal society, and the revolution from feudalist society to capitalist society. When the social class who got the power, at that time they didn't have the advanced productive forces. So most productive revolution, I think it all happened after the political forms or social relations which are has been constructed.
Right, so, but that's what the theory, what the theory says, what the classical theory says about that problem is, you would predict that the forces of production will develop much more rapidly after the revolution than before, because the existing structures are fettering or blocking the development of the forces of production. So what you have in the transition out of feudalism is that in late feudalism, the feudal relations of production are blocking the forces of production. So the Industrial Revolution cannot happen under feudalism. And the classical theory says that's why feudalism is destroyed. Feudalism is destroyed because it blocks the potential for the forces of production to further develop. Once that obstruction is destroyed, then they develop very rapidly. And that's what the bourgeois revolutions accomplish. Now, the premise there is that there are actors who recognize that fact and have an interest in that alternative. So there are bourgeois forces who see that feudalism is holding back the society. Feudalism is blocking economic activity from developing as rapidly as it could. And they can find allies among elites. So there are parts of the feudal aristocracy which already has started investing in merchant capitalism and is already part of a new coalition to challenge the old order. But that description you just gave is the description that classical historical materialism holds. So it's not that you get the development of the forces of production rapidly at the end of feudalism and then it stops. It's that you don't get very much. You get some development of forces of production in feudalism. Capitalism begins to foster some development of the forces of production. You're getting higher industrial productivity even in feudal, in the very late stages of feudalism, but it's obstructed by those old relations.
Doesn't it imply that you have a higher? It'll imply that you have a higher growth of the productive forces in early feudalism than in late feudalism.
Well, it could be in
process eventually.
Yeah, I mean the actual. Remember, in Cohen's reconstruction, there's no transition from slavery to feudalism. Those are not distinct epochs. What you have is a transition from pre-class to pre-capitalist class. So for Cohen, the history from antiquity to the end of feudalism is one long epoch. You know, from ancient Greek until the French Revolution, so to speak, is one long epoch. And within that period, then there's all sorts of things that happen, but that historical materialism doesn't have any theory of. So historical materialism does not have a specific theory of the barbarian invasions of Rome and the decadence of the Roman Empire and its disintegration. That is, it doesn't have a general theory of that. It can have particular arguments about it. So that the destruction of the form of the destruction of the Roman Empire led to actually a regression of the forces of production for a period, because the forces of production under the late Roman Empire were heavily dependent upon large-scale commerce in grain with efficient transportation systems organized under the imperial structure of the Roman Empire. When that collapses, what happens is production retreats to small enclaves and much more local production. You lose all the economies of scale that you had in the Roman Empire. And therefore, various kinds of forces of production couldn't be used anymore because they required economies of scale. So you do get a degeneration of forces of production for a few hundred years because of the chaos. But then you do get actually in the, once the new social order is stabilized, you do actually get quite a bit of development of the forces of production in feudal Europe over time. You know, it's all very complicated because it all intersects with demographic forces.
But it requires the increase in the productive forces to slow.
Eventually.
Across feudalism, or across that particular flow of production.
At the point where capitalism becomes pressing at the door.
Right.
Right.
Do you think the transition from feudalism to capitalism is gradual or rupture?
It's both. That is, there is the development of capitalistic relations inside of feudalism, in the form of merchant capitalism especially, but where people are investing and developing and accumulating. That occurs over a several hundred year period and reaches limits because of the nature, the continuing constraints imposed by feudalism. So the final emancipation of capitalist relations occurs at a rupture but the rupture is at the end of a process. By the point at which that rupture occurs, capitalism is already firmly in place as a structure of exchange relations and property relations. And that rupture then is what allows capitalism to expand rapidly and develop the dynamics it does. So it's not the case that at the time of the rupture with feudalism, feudal property relations are all still firmly functioning and intact. They are already have already degenerated in all sorts of ways. And indeed, that's one argument for an alternative model for thinking about the transformation of capitalism into socialism would be precisely that socialism has to develop inside of capitalism for a very long period of time. To the point that the socialist possibilities are what are being constrained by capitalism, but the socialist possibilities that are already functioning as opposed to socialist possibilities that we're positing in the future. Yeah.
It sounds as though that possibility makes the fettering thesis unnecessary, right? If can the interstitial developments be fettered without the larger capitalist forces of production being fettered, or in the transition from feudalism to capitalism, could those capitalist little nascent bits be fettered without the general feudal forces of production being fettered, and that mini fettering cause the rupture?
I'm not quite sure I get fully that distinction, but I think the argument from the feudal to capitalism transition is that the continuing existence of feudal relations of production and the feudal superstructure, which defends those relations of production, as the superstructure is important here, the continuing absolutist states, which corresponded to the requirements of reproducing feudalism, that those states acted as an impediment on the further development of capitalism. If they did not, that is, if it were the case that the absolutist state supporting the feudal aristocracy in its decadent, stagnant form nevertheless allowed for the full-blown flourishing of capitalism, then there wouldn't have been any particular pressure to overthrow those state apparatuses. They would have been congenial to the expansion of capitalism itself, but they acted as a fetter on capitalist relations.
So in the typical historical materialist theory, what is being fettered? Is it the new forms of production that are propping up in an interstitial way, or is it the whole system's tendencies up to that point?
Well, as Cohen frames it, what is being fettered is the development of the forces of production. But the forces of production are being developed by capitalism, and the capacity of capitalism to develop those forces of production is what's being blocked by the continuing existence of feudalism. So I don't think the argument has a clear enough specification as to distinguish between the feudal superstructure and continuing relations blocking capitalism's ability to develop the forces of production, or simply blocking the forces of production. I think it's more reasonable to see it as blocking capitalism's ability to develop the forces of production. That is, the kind of capitalism which can continue within feudalism is not the sort that can also develop the forces of production as well as a capitalism that breaks out of feudalism. And this would be equivalent, the socialism and capitalism story would be equivalent. The kind of socialism we can build inside of capitalism does make life better, does improve the realization of the potentials of these new forces of production better, but the kind of socialism that can continue to function inside of capitalism is nowhere near as effective as doing that, of doing that, as the kind of socialism that could do so if it broke out of capitalism. And then the question is whether that's an inherent fettering relation, or whether you could have a metamorphosis process by which it breaks out of capitalism. That is, where capitalism itself is transformed through metamorphosis and through a hybrid to the point where it's no longer constraining in that way. And this is, I think, a central debate. You know, it's not clear what the answer to that question is. That is, it's not clear whether socialism can grow up inside of capitalism in such a way that it, in the end, becomes the dominant form of organization through the metamorphosis of capitalist relations. That's one scenario. Or, no, socialism can grow up inside of capitalism, but it will hit absolute untransgressible limits sufficiently, when it's still sufficiently embryonic, that it can't produce all these dynamic positive effects, and that that's an untransgressible limit, that the only way you can break out of that limit is to destroy capitalism. You can't break out of it through any other way. And then if you can't destroy capitalism, then you can't destroy capitalism. You're stuck. You know, I mean, wishful thinking doesn't mean, because we know we're vulnerable to wishful thinking, we know that it's not, we know that it's false to say, because the only way socialism can really emancipate human beings is to break out of capitalism, therefore it can break out of capitalism. You know, it could be the case that that may be the only way that socialism could fully emancipate, create these potentials for emancipation, and yet that's impossible. That could be true. That's a, you know, a pessimistic view of, but you can't, optimism and pessimism doesn't have anything to do with what the actual limits of possibility might be in this sense. Now, you know, as I've suggested elsewhere, our human optimism or pessimism is part of the limits too. What's possible depends upon what people believe is possible, but it's not the same as what people believe is possible. It's affected by what people believe is possible. So a world of pessimists is actually a world with less possibility than a world of optimists. But a world of optimists still doesn't mean that the possibilities are exactly what the optimists hope for. Just there's more possibilities in a world of optimists than in a world of pessimists. Well, I think we should take our break, and then we'll begin the discussion of primarily of Arrighi's perspective. I'll also briefly talk about my earlier paper on the same general topic.